All right. So every session this week, we're going to start with a little bit of like context, whether it's the literary context or historical context, and then move into exploring the texts. So that's kind of how our sessions are going to work. So today is going to be a little longer on the context part, and then we'll do a little more discussion as we move through the week. So what is resistance? This is one scholar's. Anthea Portier-Young, who wrote this book, Apocalypse Against Empire. Her definition of resistance, anything that limits power, intentions and actions to oppose others, a refusal to accept ideas and a defense of that which is threatened, and then behaviors and practices by cultural groups that contest hegemonic forces and attempts to unravel strategies of domination. So when we're talking about these stories of resistance literature, this is kind of what we're using. Anything that's opposing the imperial forces, hegemony is going to be your non-violent control, so the structures, the non-military structures that an empire might use. And then, here we go. Into your relevant imperial historical context. Who loves empire? Can anyone think of any good things that empire does?
Builds roads.
Anything else?
Sometimes it can foster artists.
Yeah, it fosters the arts. Yeah, a lot of infrastructure. You know, the Romans built lots of aqueducts. There can sometimes be peace.
Can make trade routes safer.
Yeah, trade routes. Yeah, empire is not always bad, but it tends to not be real great for everyone. So some of the pieces that you'll want to make sure you know when looking at Daniel, the Babylonian exile is this really big narrative moment in our Hebrew scriptures. So in 587 BCE, the kingdom of Judah, which was the southern kingdom, fell to Babylon. Babylon destroyed the first Jewish temple and then brought a lot of the elites from Judah into exile. So brought them with them back to Babylon. And then you see this, you see a lot of our scriptures reacting to this historical moment. You get these laments of why have we been brought into exile. In the Book of Lamentations, you get some of this perspective of the people who were left behind in these empty cities that no longer had the people and the leadership. You get a lot of questions of why, oh God, did this happen? What did we do wrong? Why have we been brought away from the temple? And then you get perspectives like the Book of Daniel, which is about some of the narrative is about people who have been brought into exile and are Jewish but are no longer in the land of Israel. So 587 BCE, the temple is destroyed. In 539, you've got Cyrus of Persia conquers Babylon, ends exile, and allows the people of Israel to return. You had a rebuilding of the temple in 520, 515. BCE, note markers of the Persian Empire. Persian Empire is really big. They're really into administration. So lots of systems and structures, lots of communication, lots of written pieces of information. You'll see that reflected in the text when we talk about like edicts that are issued. You kind of see the text almost pushing it beyond the normal into like satire of here's this giant administration with all of these leaders, and we'll see that in some of the texts we're looking at today and tomorrow. Cyrus, even though he's an imperial leader, is depicted in some of these Hebrew scriptures as the Messiah. The Hebrew scriptures are structured differently than how Christians look at the Old Testament. The last book in the Tanakh, which is the Jewish name for the Hebrew scriptures, is Chronicles. And the very last verse of Chronicles has Cyrus declaring the end of exile. And these texts depict Cyrus as like this liberator and messiah for the Jewish people, which is an interesting piece of these texts. You also, I think, see him depicted that way in parts of Isaiah, and I think maybe one of the Psalms. I could be wrong on that one. But yeah, if you want to look at the end of Chronicles, then you'll see that. So I think that's kind of interesting. Rebuilding of the temple. If you remember from earlier parts of scripture, the temple is seen as this place where God resides and where God meets the people. And so when all of a sudden there is no temple anymore, it's really this theological crisis for the people of Israel. After Persia comes Greece. Alexander the Great conquers Persia. The Greek Empire is in power in these lands for quite a while. And then Antiochus IV is the other leader we're going to be talking about. And we will get into him a little more in the next couple days. But Antiochus, in an attempt to centralize power, eventually outlaws practice of the Jewish religion and attempts to erase Jewish identity and tradition. There's lots of persecution. There's defiling of the second temple that was built, ransacking it, lots of massacres. It's one of the first times in history where a state attempts to force people to convert to a state religion. And so we'll see that in our text as well as we explore Daniel. So the book of Daniel is both reflecting and reacting to some of these different imperial pressures. So Babylon and Persia show up in our texts, and Greece is kind of this undercurrent. That was kind of a scattered overview. We will go into more detail, but I'm going to pause here for any questions about these major events.
And Antiochus was Greek.
Was Greek, okay. Yes. He was in the Seleucids. I don't speak Greek. That's my best guess. So he's a couple hundred years after Alexander the Great. Yes.
So was the language of Babylon Hebrew?
Ooh, I don't know what the language of Babylon
it
was.
It seemed to me that Daniel's written in Aramaic, right?
Daniel's written in Hebrew and Aramaic.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a minute. Aramaic is the language of Persia. But I'm not sure what the language of Babylon is.
Well, I mean, I think that there was a modernizing trend that changed, that influenced Aramaic into Hebrew. And okay. So all these shifts that happen with the consonants, especially, then I think that's right. I'm not sure.
I'm not a biblical language scholar by any means.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Babylonian is its own language. I mean, when you look at the scholarship, Dr. Hood, that just did it.
Yeah, so you'll see as we're moving on.
Daniel's written in there, part of it. Yeah, we know.
Yeah, Daniel, part of why I really love Daniel is you've got some really interesting stories, but it's also just really kind of weird. In terms of like this mishmash of languages, of genre, of historical timeline that doesn't actually match up with the historical timeline. You jump around a lot. So part of the book of Daniel, as you can see, is written in Hebrew, the very first chapter, and then the last five. And then the middle parts are written in Aramaic, which again is that language of the Persian Empire. And then you've also got two very distinct genres in the book of Daniel. You've got these court tales in the first half of the book, and these apocalyptic visions in the second half. And they don't line up with the language, which there's something really interesting going on there. And then the narrative bounces around a lot from Babylonian leaders to Persian leaders, back to Babylonian leaders. Like, it's just all over the place, which, it's just, there's something really interesting going on there. The book of Daniel reflects a lot of stories that were probably oral tradition for a long time. The court tales that we're going to be talking about today and tomorrow were likely an oral tradition from the Babylonian and the Persian period, but scholars think that the book itself came to its final form during the Greek period, likely after the time of Antiochus, or around the time of Antiochus. If we go back to this date with Antiochus, the Maccabean revolt that leads to the celebration of Hanukkah is like 164, I think, and is a response to this persecution in Jerusalem. At one point, Antiochus apparently ordered the massacre of like every Jewish man, and like ordered all the women and children sold into slavery. Like, there's stories of like babies being thrown off of walls. Like, it's this really intense reign of state terror, which is not necessarily abnormal for an empire, but is really different approach from these earlier empires. So Babylon takes people away into exile. Persia's way of holding power was to allow people to mostly do what they wanted to do. As long as you're following these major laws of the Persian Empire, like, they encourage people to continue practicing local customs that didn't contradict with that, to continue following your own religion. They didn't limit the practice of whatever religion people had. And then you see some of that reversed with Antiochus figuring that the best way to concentrate power was by outlawing the practice of Judaism in Jerusalem. So as we get into these texts of Daniel, you see places where the narrative reflects this state repression of the practice of Judaism or the practice of other laws or of other religions, but that's not actually a reality in the Persian Empire. It's not really a reality in the Babylonian Empire either, but it is a reality in the Greek Empire. And so this is one of the pieces why I think this functions as resistance literature, is the narrative reflects more of the reality of life under the Greeks, but doesn't name it as life under the Greeks. Because when you're living under a ruler who's ready to squash you, you can't really criticize that ruler very well. But if you, and I'm going way ahead, I'm not going to get here quite yet, but if you tell a story that people will recognize as being a critique of current life, but you place it in the past and blame it on someone else, then that's a safer way to tell that story. So, we'll move on, and we'll get into some more of that as we talk about some of these texts. So, again, Daniel has a lot going on. There's move from Hebrew to Aramaic, back to Hebrew. We talk about these court tales and then these apocalyptic visions. So the court tales really are kind of looking at this question of what does it mean to live faithfully under foreign powers? What does it mean to be Jewish when you can't be in the temple? And it follows some of the tradition of these stories that exist elsewhere in the Hebrew scriptures, specifically like Joseph and Esther both kind of wrestle with the same kinds of questions. Joseph is in the Egyptian court after his brother sold him into slavery. That story is found in the end of Genesis. And again, you've got this narrative of this man who's all alone in a different court who manages to like gain the favor of the king. And then in Esther, you kind of see it again with Esther, who is Jewish, who gains the favor of the Persian king, the Persian leader, and then manages to save her people through that story. So that's kind of where this fits in the overall genre of court tales. Encourage you to spend some time in those other court tales if you're not super familiar with them. And then in Daniel, in these court tales, we've got these two different kinds of structures. We've got these narratives of interpretation, where the general structure is the leader has a vision, the wise men in his court cannot help, they don't have the answer, they can't give him the interpretation that he wants, and it's always a he, which is why I'm using that pronoun. The hero interprets the story. Generally, that's Daniel. The hero is then rewarded. The hero's god is discovered as all-powerful. Sometimes people worship them. Sometimes that god is just named as being all-powerful. And then we also have these narratives of deliverance. The king demands worship of an idol. The hero disobeys and is discovered. Hero doesn't comply, is set to be executed. Hero is delivered. Enemies are punished. And then the hero's god is discovered. So that second one, I think, are stories that I would guess are a little more familiar to folks. That's going to be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel and the lion's den. But those are kind of our two stories. So, any questions before we move into the text? Great. Okay, so we're going to read Daniel chapter 1, and we're going to read the whole chapter. So if you have a Bible and want to turn to it, I do have the text on the screen, but the text is long enough, it doesn't all fit on one slide. So if you are the kind of person who likes to be able to follow along and refer back, then I would recommend that you open up the text. The book of Daniel is like relatively far back in Old Testament, after the book of Ezekiel, which is really long, and like 5 first. And then because I really value hearing other voices, I'm going to ask for a couple of volunteers to read some of this out loud. I think I've got the text on 3 different slides, so if I could have 3 different leaders, one for each slide. Who wants to volunteer to read? All right, Kathy, I'll have you do slide 1. Jason, I'll have you do slide 2. And do I have a third? Joel, you can do slide 3.
In the 3rd year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King... Does anyone have a...
My advice is just pick a pronunciation and be confident.
Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. These he brought to the land of Shinar and placed the vessels in the treasury of his gods. Then the king commanded his palace master Ashpenaz to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, and competent to serve in the king's palace. They were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. They were to be educated for 3 years, so that at the end of that time, they could be stationed in the king's court. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master gave them other names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego.
But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. So he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now, God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head with the king." Then Daniel asked the guard, whom the palace master had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Let me be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. You can then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men who eat the royal rations, and deal with your servants according to what you observe. So he agreed to this proposal and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was observed that they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to withdraw their royal rations and the wine they were to drink, and then gave them vegetables. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams. At the end of the time that the king had set for them to be brought in, the palace master brought them to the presence of Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among them all, no one was found to compare with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they were stationed in the king's court. In every matter of wisdom and understanding concerning which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel continued there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Thank you. And Joel, I'm sorry, I was wrong. There were only 2 slides, so you're off the hook for today. All right, so now I would love you all to get into groups of like 2 or 3. We're going to spend some time talking in small groups, and then we'll come back together as a big group. And these are the questions I want you to think about. Given kind of this lens of empire and resistance, just look at, like, I notice, what do you notice? So think, I notice this, or what do you wonder about? Are there pieces in the text that you're really curious about? Oh, this is interesting. What's going on here? Where do you see empire in the text, and who holds the power? So, if you want to get into groups of 2 or 3, and we'll talk for like 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how conversations are going, and then we'll come back together as a big group.
Boss, get in because you were in the corner because you're like, no, I don't have people.
What do you notice?
And talking about the subversion of power and all of those things.
All right, if you want to all return back to the group. Wonderings and noticings. What were some of the other questions you had about this text? What things stood out? What do you wish you knew more about?
Aside from food, what were the changes in their daily routine that the Babylonians experienced under Nebuchadnezzar?
So like, what was life in exile like?
Yeah. Day-to-day routine.
Okay. What other questions arose for you?
Well, I'm just curious, and I didn't think about it until the end. How were these Israelites of royal family and nobility able to keep that status?
I was interested in the role of the middle manager.
The palace master,
who is exercising his own form of resistance by not doing what the king wants him to do, possibly to his own peril if they end up all, you know,
withering
weak and withered.
Yes.
How common was the practice of changing someone's name of a minority?
And similarly, we talked about changing someone's diet, forcing them to a diet if they're not.
It was like forced assimilation.
Yeah.
And their education.
And education. Wonderings in your time spent with the text?
You have the guard who was the one who actually, who was under the middle manager, who was the one who made the decision.
Yeah, you've got a lot of interesting characters in this short story. Okay.
It's also interesting to me that I remember Shadrach, and I remember Meshach, and I remember Abednego, but I don't remember the original name. So, like, even the power of that, the way that the story is told, it's the names that then are put on them.
Right. Except for Daniel.
Except for Daniel.
Well, I remember Daniel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, life in exile. You see this in the first couple of verses. After Nebuchadnezzar takes power, he brings the vessels, he brings things to his treasury, and then the king commanded his palace master to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility. So not one of the tensions of exile is that not everyone goes into exile. You see this reflected in some of these other scriptural references, especially in Ezra and Nehemiah, when exile ends, of the tension between the people who were left behind and the people who were taken away. And the people who were taken away were mostly the elites. The Babylonians took the people who were maintaining the structure, the well-educated, the wealthy, they took those people with them and left behind the poor folks, the ones who weren't as well established. So then Daniel is dealing with life in exile, which is not going to be the common people. It's going to be the ones that the empire thought would benefit them to take them away. And I think that's part of why you see people like Daniel ending up in the court, because it's not just your average person. It's probably folks from the priestly class who already had some of that education, who the empire saw and was like, oh, they would be a really helpful resource to have with me here in Babylon. Let's take them both so they can't cause trouble in this land we just conquered, and because they can probably benefit us here. This question of assimilation comes up a lot here of, who has the right to give you a name? That's a really interesting question. Like, my name came from my parents. No one's ever tried to change it. I've never thought about changing it. But when the empire says, you have to change it, or here's your new name, this is what I'm going to call you, that's an interesting imperial pressure. And you see this is a continual question in the book of Daniel, of who has the right to give you your name, who has the right to order your life. And Daniel over and over again asserts that God is the one with the ultimate power, that empire isn't the one. That empire can tell you to do these things, to eat differently, to call you a different name, but again and again we come back to this claim that God is the only one who gets to order your life, that God is the only one who gets to like change change your name, change your identity. But that's very much, you see this in colonial empires around the world throughout history. One of the ways of controlling people and controlling and centralizing your power is to order the lives of your citizens so that they can't resist, they can't rise up. You're controlling the supply chain, all sorts of things. Nancy.
Which is even in the history of immigration in the United States, name changing is mm-hmm. very really common story in families.
Yeah.
And when there people came to the border, the immigration person said, well, I can't pronounce that name, so you're going to be called this. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of names like that, tons of stories like that in all of our history, too. So, I mean, whoever's in charge of the person across the border gets that, also that naming power.
Yeah. Really good point. And when do you push back against that? And when do you say, this is how I'm going to survive?
Yeah.
And I'm going to survive by doing what the people in power tell me to do. Yeah.
While I subvert in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard your group, Kathy, talking about that even when the Babylonians give these four individuals their names, that the narrator returns to the Hebrew name. Yeah. And so, like, the empire can say that's your name, but is that the name you're going to use? Yeah, that's an interesting question.
I also found the servant, there's a line in here about how the servant was withholding their rations, and it suggests that, like, he's taking them for himself, mm-hmm. because he is also part of this chain of oppression. He mm-hmm. is both oppressed and oppressing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so in giving them, not giving them the rations, but the vegetables instead, he is getting something for himself, maybe to take down his family or just to himself.
Yeah, and that's a thing we see in imperial structures around the world too, is you get these groups of people who are being oppressed but are able to turn around and, like, oppress someone else, and in that way, like, maintain some status.
It's the middle manager
part. Yeah, it's the middle manager part. We see it in this country right now with, like, white women.
Yes.
Right? Of that being this, like, white women are closer to the patriarchy. And they benefit from white supremacy, but are also oppressed by the patriarchy, but turn around and use those same systems to keep themselves, like, speaking as a white woman, like, to keep ourselves, like, higher than other oppressed classes. And I think sometimes it's a method of survival, of how do you survive in a system that is built to keep a few people at the top and oppress everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the tension between, like, surviving, which is, there is a success to just surviving, mm-hmm. but it depends on you becoming part of the evil system in mm-hmm. order to survive. And so do you, like, say, I'm willing to die for this? Or do you say, I have to survive to feed my kids?
It also creates this sense that between the two powers, the power of, the Babylonians, in order to, if you see that in this story, it erodes, right? Mm-hmm. Because it has to go from person to person to person, and if anybody along that line is actually, like, human power is subverting that power, then that power is eroding, right? Versus the power of the Lord, who gives Daniel what he needs, and there's no, it's like a direct connection versus a line of decision-making that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see this middle manager character who maybe is benefiting for himself, maybe, but also is allowing this different ending to take place, is allowing Daniel and Mishael and Hananiah and Azariah to resist. Yeah, there's some interesting, like, narrative tensions within this.
But at possibly very great peril to himself, because if God hadn't interceded and made them not wither, he would have gotten in terrible trouble with the palace master, and the palace master would have gotten in trouble with the king. And so, like, the chain.
And why did he do that then? That's a question.
Yeah.
That's actually just the power of vegetarianism.
We proved
that up here.
That when you eat vegetarian and drink water, you'll get fatter and bigger and better looking than everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear to me why he, why the servant does it. And how nobody notices that he's like spiriting away bags of food at night, you know?
Yeah.
I think just like we've kind of talked about how they're already elites, these particular four, but also they're able-bodied. They're also, there's a lot of privilege there, and I think that that is something.
And they're already well-educated. Yeah. They just need to get some different education, and then they'll be ready to go. All right, so where all did you see empire in that text? And who holds the power?
It's come up in some of the answers in terms of like name changing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that. You get stripped from your culture. Mm-hmm.
Taking the vessels, the golden vessels, are out of the temple and offering them to the gods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The middleman, the middle manager here in a footnote is known as chief of the eunuchs, and one might assume that he wasn't born a eunuch. He gave up something to have that position, so there is a power of empire over his life in some pretty meaningful ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and was that his choice, or was it someone else's choice? Okay, so this wasn't a question I had you think about, but I now want you to think about. Like, where? How do you think this text is resistance, or functions as resistance literature? What is subversive about this story and the way it is told?
Well, the subversions work. They succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that nobody is discovered. So there's no consequence to pushing back.
Yeah, they manage to like pull one in Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't find out. Yeah, they don't live the way empire tells them to live. Mm-hmm. And there's no consequences.
But they don't do it with, like, they don't fight against, they're mm-hmm. not fighting violently against the empire. Mm-hmm. They're doing it with like cunning and smarts and negotiation, because they couldn't, these are four guys, they're not going to survive if somebody, you know, somebody comes in with an axe, they're not going to survive. So they resist in a way that preserves their life, and it comes up in some, they are smarter than everybody else in the room, and so they can negotiate their way to life.
Yeah, and what does it mean that the smartest people in the room are not the Babylonian leaders?
Mm-hmm. Well, it means that they were right to not to take these people, because if they left them in Israel, right, they could rebuild.
Right. But I would challenge too that I don't know that it's a matter of them. If I was a religious person, I would say it's a matter of their own faithfulness to God, not their smart. That they continue to say, I'm not going to defile mm-hmm. myself. In verse 8, I'm going to listen to, God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion. So it's through their own piety, their own faithfulness and loyalty to God that they prevail in this situation. It's also interesting grammatically there in verse 9, how God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master, and not that like God moved the palace yeah. master to show favor and compassion.
It is a passive.
But that's that's an interesting. Yeah.
But the same is, or at least in my text, the Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power. It's that same passive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are three places where there's God talk. You've identified those two, and then there's that one toward the, what's that? Right, verse 17, to these four men God gave knowledge. Yep. So, the cunning, the text acknowledges is that God gave them that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's still not this, it isn't like in, what was it, Exodus, where God hardens the hearts or mm-hmm. or has mm-hmm. some sort of power over the Babylonians.
And Julia, I would note that that's kind of the big theological mm-hmm. question of a lot of these scriptures is why does exile happen? Mm-hmm. You see this theological wrestling of what did we do wrong mm-hmm. that caused us mm-hmm. us to lose, that caused the temple to be destroyed.
Is it making reference to the Tower of Babel and like the sin of the peoples?
I don't think it's referring to Babel. I don't think there's a connection between the Babylonian Empire and the Tower of Babel that you see in Genesis. But this, I mean, these first couple of verses are talking about the fall of Jerusalem.
Okay.
And the destruction of the temple. Yeah.
Maybe one of the big questions then is something which is something we struggle with a lot in reading, especially reading the Hebrew scriptures, is the agency of God
mm-hmm.
in all of this. Mm-hmm. Just like we read that and go, you know, God did that. But in reading the narrative, you have to try and understand the perspective of their understanding of the agency of God,
mm-hmm.
for good or ill.
And then maybe the response is like the agency of God through the agency of people.
Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but so it's like we have to kind of regroup our thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of texts where is God the one acting here? Are humans the one acting here? Like, what's the difference? What does that all mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
And yeah, where is God in the lives of all the poor people left behind? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
Where's that story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get the Book of Lamentations. Kind of is more from that perspective of the first verse of the Book of Lamentations is how lonely sits the city that once was full of people. And you see some of the tension then in Ezra, Nehemiah, when the people are returning from exile to rebuild. And the elites who've been exiled think they are the ones who know everything. Mm-hmm. They come back and they're like, great, we're gonna come back, we're gonna be in power again. And oh look, the land isn't empty. There's people who've been living here for 50 years who like also want to say what's happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, we're about out of time for today. Thank you for wrestling with these texts with me. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 3, which is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and Daniel chapter 6, which is the lion's den. So possibly a bit more familiar stories, but we'll be dealing a lot with some of the resistance and looking at how empire is reflected, and I'm excited. So. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Kristen.